It's my pleasure, obviously, to welcome the actors for this occasion, the readers, Juliet Stevenson and Silvestre de Tuzo. And Di Spears, who's the champion editor of readings on BBC Radio 4, who's going to introduce this evening. So I'm going to hand over straight away to Di Spears.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. And it's lovely, as always, to be back on the platform here at Small Wonder. And even more of a pleasure and privilege tonight to be here with two of Britain's finest actors, Juliet Stevenson and Silvestre de Tuzo. They need no introduction to you, I'm sure. Both have had long and illustrious careers from their very early years at the RSC to leading roles on stage and screen, too numerous to mention here. But equally important to my mind, and given what I do, and indeed to this evening, they're both consummate radio actors and superb readers who I've always felt incredibly lucky to direct, and I think you were all very lucky to hear. What may be less well known to you is they're both also writers of short works. Juliet's written essays for Radio 3, and indeed you can hear her reading one of them in a couple of weeks' time. And Silvestre is, appropriately for Small Wonder, herself a successful writer of short stories with an MA in creative life writing from Goldsmiths. So, which is very impressive. So, Virginia Woolf's extraordinary prose, which you're going to hear tonight, couldn't really be in better hands. Before you hear the stories, though, I thought I'd give you just a little bit of context about them, because I don't know how many people know very much about these stories. They are two out of seven in total, from a collection entitled Mrs. Dalloway's Party, which has been republished rather beautifully this year by Vintage. Many of you, I'm sure, will have read Mrs. Dalloway, one of Virginia Woolf's most revolutionary novels, and you'll be familiar with her hugely influential non-fiction, not least A Room of One's Own. I'm imagining this whole room is full of Woolf aficionados who are going to pick me up on any mistakes. And you may know some of her more acclaimed and groundbreaking short stories too, Kew Gardens, an unwritten novel, Mark on the Wall. But in general, although short stories were something that she wrote throughout her life, I think some 45 in total, her shorter works have tended to be rather overlooked by readers and critics. Yet they were always really important to her, and in them you can find both the themes for the longer works and the innovative and impressionistic writing techniques which were to prove so influential, not just on her fiction, but on the whole 20th century fiction. In 1943, 2 years after her death, her husband Leonard gathered many of her stories into a volume, A Haunted House and Other Stories. Reviewing them for the New York Times Book Review, the great American short story writer Eudora Welty wrote, "They seem as perfect and as functional for all their beauty as spider webs. Indeed, they were made for like purpose, to trap and dissect living morsels in the form of palpitating moments of time, instantaneous perceptions. They are as much a matter of the senses as a concern of the intellect." It's clear when you read Woolf's stories that they're often a place where she could write at her most experimental. She used the genre to try new ways of exploring and revealing those moments of being, those instances of intense sensibility that were so vital to her. Indeed, one story is subtitled Moments of Being. She was trying out form, particularly the interior monologue, and experimenting with streams of consciousness and with free direct, indirect discourse when the character's voice gets completely embedded in the narration, and you'll hear that tonight. She was also, from time to time, exploring ideas and themes for novels. One of the stories we're about to hear, Mrs. Dalloway in Bond Street, was originally intended as the first chapter of Mrs. Dalloway. It isn't, by the way, the first time Clarissa and Richard Dalloway are mentioned in Woolf's fiction. That was back in 1915, so Clarissa had obviously haunted her for some years. But by the early 1920s, when Virginia was living a rather isolated and quiet life in Richmond, she began to combine the idea of Clarissa with the very powerful yearning to dig deeper into the heightened sensibilities of the social event, which she was missing, and in particular, the party. In Downhill All the Way, Leonard Woolf wrote of his wife that the idea of the party always excited her, And in practice, she was very sensitive to the actual mental and physical excitement of the party itself, the rise of temperature of mind and body, the ferment and fountain of noise. These stories and the novel that were born out of that obsession. But the collection Mrs. Dalloway's Party was not something that either of the Wolfes put together as a conceit at all. In 1973, an inspired editor and academic, Stella McNichol, gathered 7 stories, in some cases not so much more than a fragment, and 2 never previously published, which, whatever their length, seemed all to be in some way satellites or offshoots of Mrs. Dalloway. Some are clearly part of the genesis of the novel, Mrs. Dalloway at Bond Street for one, but interestingly, most of the stories were written after the novel itself was completed and dispatched, as if the minor characters and the very sense of that occasion, that one party, wouldn't quite leave the author alone. In these stories, for example, in The New Dress, the reader is taken right into the heart of how it feels to be in the middle of the hubbub, but suffering hugely heightened self-consciousness. Who hasn't felt that sensation that every eye is on you and that everything about you is at odds not only with all those about you, but with everything that you intended when you got dressed that evening? The New Dress was written while Virginia Woolf was revising Mrs. Dalloway in 1924. With this story and the others, she was able, and so were her readers, I think, to go where the novel could not, following other characters, capturing other viewpoints, exploring other perspectives. And in today, reading fiction, contemporary fiction now, we're really used to that idea of the multiple narrators. But once again here, you see Virginia Woolf doing something that was really at the cutting edge. Anyway, I will let you judge for yourselves, and I do hope you enjoy these stories. I think they're treasures. And I'm going to ask Juliet Stevenson first to read Mrs. Dalloway in Bond Street. Thank you.
Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the gloves herself. Big Ben was striking as she stepped out into the street. It was 11 o'clock, and the unused hour was fresh, as if issued to children on a beach. But there was something solemn in the deliberate swing of the repeated strokes, something stirring in the murmur of wheels and the shuffle of footsteps. No doubt they were not all bound on errands of happiness. There is much more to be said about us than that we walk the streets of Westminster. Big Ben, too, is nothing but steel rods, consumed by rust, were it not for the care of HM's Office of Works. Only for Mrs. Dalloway, the moment was complete. For Mrs. Dalloway, June was fresh. A happy childhood, and it was not to his daughters only that Justin Parry had seemed a fine fellow, weak, of course, on the bench. Flowers at evening, smoke rising, the core of rooks falling from ever so high, down, down through the October air. There is nothing to take the place of childhood. A leaf of mint brings it back, or a cup with a blue ring. Poor little wretches, she sighed, and pressed forward. Oh, right under the horses' noses, you little demon! And there she was, left on the curb, stretching her hand out, while Jimmy Dawes grinned on the further side. A charming woman, posed, eager, strangely white-haired for her pink cheeks. So Scope Purvis, C.B., saw her as he hurried to his office. She stiffened a little, waiting for Dirtnell's van to pass. Big Ben struck the 10th, struck the 11th stroke. Leaden circles dissolved in the air. Pride held her erect, inheriting, handing on, acquainted with discipline and with suffering. How people suffered. How they suffered, she thought, thinking of Mrs. Foxcroft at the embassy last night, decked with jewels, eating her heart out, because that nice boy was dead. And now the old manor house, Dirtnell's van, passed, must go to a cousin. Good morning to you, said Hugh Whitbread, raising his hat rather extravagantly by the china shop, for they had known each other as children. Where are you off to? I love walking in London, said Mrs. Dalloway. Really, it's better than walking in the country. We've just come up, said Hugh Whitbread, unfortunately, to see doctors. Millie, said Mrs. Dalloway, instantly compassionate.
out of sorts, said Hugh Whitbread. That sort of thing. Dick all right. First rate, said Clarissa. Of course, she thought, walking on, Millie is about my age, 50, 52, so it is probably that. Hugh's manner had said so, said it perfectly. Dear old Hugh, thought Mrs. Dalloway, remembering with amusement, with gratitude, with emotion, how shy, like a brother, one would rather die than speak to one's brother, Hugh had always been when he was at Oxford and came over, and perhaps one of them, drat the thing, couldn't ride. How then could women sit in Parliament? How could they do things with men? For there is this extraordinarily deep instinct, something inside one. You can't get over it. It's no use trying. And men like Hugh respect it without our saying it, which is what one loves, thought Clarissa, in dear old Hugh. She'd passed through the Admiralty Arch and saw at the end of the empty road, with its thin trees, Victoria's white mound, Victoria's billowing motherliness, amplitude and homeliness. Always ridiculous, yet how sublime, thought Mrs. Dalloway, remembering Kensington Gardens and the old lady in horn spectacles, and being told by Nanny to stop dead still and bow to the Queen. The flag flew above the palace. The King and Queen were back then. Dick had met her at lunch the other day, a thoroughly nice woman. It matters so much to the poor, thought Clarissa, and to the soldiers. A man in bronze stood heroically on a pedestal with a gun on her left-hand side. The South African War. It matters, thought Mrs. Dalloway, walking towards Buckingham Palace. There it stood, four square, in the broad sunshine, uncompromising, plain. But it was character, she thought, something inborn in the race, what Indians respected. The Queen went to hospitals, opened bazaars. The Queen of England, thought Clarissa, looking at the palace. Already at this hour, a motor car passed out at the gates. Soldiers saluted. The gates were shut. And Clarissa, crossing the road, entered the park, holding herself upright. June had drawn out every leaf on the trees. The mothers of Westminster with mottled breasts gave suck to their young. Quite respectable girls lay stretched on the grass. An elderly man, stooping very stiffly, picked up a crumpled paper, spread it out flat, and flung it away. How horrible. Last night at the embassy, Sir Dighton had said, "If I want a fellow to hold my horse, I only have to put my hand up." But the religious question is far more serious than the economic, Sir Dighton had said, which she thought extraordinarily interesting from a man like Sir Dighton. "Oh, the country will never know what it has lost," he had said, talking of his own accord about dear Jack Stewart. She mounted the little hill lightly. The air stirred with energy. Messages were passing from the fleet to the Admiralty. Piccadilly and Arlington Street and the Mall seemed to chafe the very air in the park and lift its leaves hotly, brilliantly, upon waves of that divine vitality which Clarissa loved. To ride, to dance. She adored all that. Or going long walks in the country, talking about books or what to do with one's life. The young people were amazingly priggish. Oh, the things one had said. But one had conviction. Middle age is the devil. People like Jack will never know that, she thought. For he never once thought of death, they said. Never, they said, knew he was dying. And now can never mourn, how did it go? A head grown grey from the contagion of the world's slow stain have drunk their cup a round or two before. From the contagion of the world's slow stain. She held herself upright. But how Jack would have shouted, quoting Shelley in Piccadilly. "You want a pin," he would have said. He hated frumps. "God, Clarissa! My God, Clarissa!" She could hear him now at the Devonshire House party about poor Sylvia Hunt in her amber necklace and that dowdy old silk. Clarissa held herself upright, for she had spoken aloud, and now she was in Piccadilly, passing the house with the slender green columns and the balconies. passing club windows full of newspapers, passing old Lady Burdett Court's house, where the glazed white parrot used to hang, and Devonshire House without its gilt leopards, and Claridge's, where she must remember Dick wanted her to leave a card on Mrs. Jepson, or she would be gone. Rich Americans can be very charming. There was St. James's Palace, like a child's game with bricks. And now she had passed Bond Street. She was by Hatchard's bookshop. The stream was endless, endless, endless. Lords, Ascot, Hurlingham, what was it? What a duck, she thought, looking at the frontispiece of some book of memoirs spread wide in the bow window. Sir Joshua, perhaps, or Romney, arch, bright, demure, the sort of girl like her own Elizabeth, the only real sort of girl. And there was that absurd book, Soapy Sponge, which Jum used to quote by the yard, and Shakespeare's sonnets. She knew them all by heart. Phil and she had argued all day about the dark lady, and Dick had said straight out at dinner that night that he'd never even heard of her. Well, really, she'd married him for that. He'd never read Shakespeare. There must be some cheap little book she could buy for Milly. Cranford, of course. Was there ever anything so enchanting as the cow in petticoats? If only people had that sort of humour, that sort of self-respect now, thought Clarissa. For she remembered the broad pages, the sentences ending, the characters, how one talked about them as if they were real. For all the great things, one must go to the past, she thought. From the contagion of the world's slow stain, fear no more the heat of the sun, and now can never mourn. Can never mourn, she repeated, her eyes straying over the window, for it ran in her head, the test of great poetry. The moderns had never written anything one wanted to read about death, she thought, and turned. Omnibuses joined motor cars. Motor cars, vans, vans, taxicabs, motor cars. Here was an open motor car with a girl, alone. Up till 4, her feet tingling. I know, thought Clarissa, for the girl looked washed out, half asleep in the corner of the car after the dance. And another car came, and another. No, no, no! Clarissa smiled good-naturedly. The fat lady had taken every sort of trouble, but diamonds, orchids, at this hour of the morning? No, no, no. The excellent policeman would, when the time came, hold up his hand. Another motor car passed. How utterly unattractive. Why should a girl of that age paint black round her eyes? And a young man with a girl, at this hour, when the country... The admirable policeman raised his hand, and Clarissa, acknowledging his sway, taking her time, crossed, walked towards Bond Street, saw the narrow, crooked street, the yellow banners, the thick, notched telegraph wires stretched across the sky. 100 years ago, her great-great-grandfather, Seymour Parry, who ran away with Conway's daughter, had walked down Bond Street. Down Bond Street the Parrys had walked for 100 years, and might have met the Dalloways, Lees on the mother's side, going up. Her father got his clothes from Hills. There was a roll of cloth in the window, and here just one jar on a black table, incredibly expensive, like the thick pink salmon on the ice block at the fishmonger's. The jewels were exquisite pink and orange stars. Paste, Spanish, she thought, and chains of old gold, starry buckles, little brooches which had been worn on sea-green satin by ladies with high headdresses. But no looking. One must economize. She must go on past the picture dealers where one of the odd French pictures hung, as if people had thrown confetti, pink and blue, for a joke. If you had lived with pictures, and it's the same with books and music, thought Clarissa, passing the Aeolian Hall, you can't be taken in by a joke. The river of Bond Street was clogged. There, like a queen at a tournament, raised, regal, was Lady Bexborough. She sat in her carriage, upright, alone, looking through her glasses. The white glove was loose at her wrist. She was in black, quite shabby, yet, thought Clarissa, how extraordinarily it tells, breeding, self-respect, never saying a word too much or letting people gossip. An astonishing friend. No one can pick a hole in her after all these years. And now there she is, thought Clarissa, passing the Countess, who waited powdered, perfectly still. And Clarissa would have given anything to be like that. The mistress of Clarefield, talking politics like a man. But she never goes anywhere, thought Clarissa. And it's quite useless to ask her. And the carriage went on, and Lady Bexborough was borne past like a queen at a tournament, though she had nothing to live for. And the old man is failing, and they say she is sick of it all, thought Clarissa. And the tears actually rose to her eyes as she entered the shop. "Good morning," said Clarissa in her charming voice. "Gloves," she said with her exquisite friendliness, and putting her bag on the counter began very slowly to undo the buttons. "White gloves," she said, "above the elbow." And she looked straight into the shopwoman's face. But this was not the girl she remembered. She looked quite old. "These really don't fit," said Clarissa. The shop girl looked at them. "Madame wears bracelets?" Clarissa spread out her fingers. "Perhaps it's my rings." And the girl took the grey gloves with her to the end of the counter. "Yes," thought Clarissa, "it's the girl I remember. She's 20 years older." There was only one other customer, sitting sideways at the counter, her elbow poised, her bare hand drooping vacant. Like a figure on a Japanese fan, thought Clarissa. Too vacant, perhaps, yet some men would adore her. The lady shook her head sadly. Again the gloves were too large. She turned round the glass. "Above the wrist," she reproached the grey-headed woman, who looked and agreed. They waited. A clock ticked. Bond Street hummed, dulled, distant. The woman went away, holding gloves. "Above the wrist," said the lady, mournfully raising her voice. And she would have to order chairs, ices, flowers, and cloakroom tickets, thought Clarissa. The people she didn't want would come, the others wouldn't. She would stand by the door. They sold stockings, silk stockings. A lady is known by her gloves and her shoes, old Uncle William used to say. And through the hanging silk stockings, quivering silver, she looked at the lady, sloping-shouldered, her hand drooping, her bag slipping, her eyes vacantly on the floor. It would be intolerable if dowdy women came to her party. Would one have liked Keats if he had worn red socks? Oh, at last, she drew into the counter, and it flashed into her mind. "Do you remember before the war you had gloves with pearl buttons?" "French gloves, madam?" "Yes, they were French," said Clarissa. The other lady rose very sadly and took her bag and looked at the gloves on the counter. But they were all too large, always too large at the wrist. "With pearl buttons," said the shop girl, who looked ever so much older. She split the lengths of tissue paper apart on the counter. "With pearl buttons," thought Clarissa. "Perfectly simple. How French." "Madame's hands are so slender," said the shop girl, drawing the glove firmly, smoothly down over her rings. And Clarissa looked at her arm in the looking-glass. The glove hardly came to the elbow. Were there others, half an inch longer? Still, it seemed tiresome to bother her. Perhaps the one day in the month, thought Clarissa, when it's an agony to stand. "Oh, don't bother," she said. But the gloves were brought. "Don't you get fearfully tired?" she said in her charming voice. "Standing? When do you get your holiday?"
"In September, madam, when we're not so busy."
"When we're in the country," thought Clarissa. "Or shooting. She has a fortnight in Brighton, in some stuffy lodging. The landlady takes the sugar. Nothing would be easier than to send her to Mrs. Lumley's right in the country, and it was on the tip of her tongue. But then she remembered how, on their honeymoon, Dick had shown her the folly of giving impulsively. It was much more important, he said, to get trade with China. Of course he was right. And she could feel the girl wouldn't like to be given things. There she was in her place. So was Dick. Selling gloves was her job. She had her own sorrows, quite separate. And now can never mourn. Can never mourn. The words ran in her head. From the contagion of the world's slow stain, thought Clarissa, holding her arm stiff. For there are moments when it seems utterly futile. The glove was drawn off, leaving her arm flecked with powder. Simply one doesn't believe, thought Clarissa, any more in God. The traffic suddenly roared. The silk stockings brightened. A customer came in. "White gloves," she said, with some ring in her voice that Clarissa remembered. It used, thought Clarissa, to be so simple. Down, down through the air came the caw of the rooks. When Sylvia died hundreds of years ago, the yew hedges looked so lovely with the diamond webs in the mist before early church. But if Dick were to die tomorrow? As for believing in God, no, she would let the children choose, but for herself, like Lady Bexborough, who opened the bazaar, they say, with a telegram in her hand, Roden, her favourite, killed, she would go on. But why? If one doesn't believe. For the sake of others, she thought, taking the glove in her hand. The girl would be much more unhappy if she didn't believe. 30 shillings, said the shopwoman. Oh, no, pardon me, madame. 35. The French gloves are more. For one doesn't live for oneself, thought Clarissa. And then the other customer took a glove, tugged it, and it split. There, she exclaimed. Or fault of the skin, said the grey-haired woman hurriedly. Sometimes a drop of acid in tanning. Try this pair, madame. But it's an awful swindle to ask £2.10. Clarissa looked at the lady. The lady looked at Clarissa. Gloves had never been quite so reliable since the war, said the shop girl, apologising to Clarissa. But where had she seen the other lady? Elderly, with a frill under her chin, wearing a black ribbon for gold eyeglasses. Sensual, clever, like a sergeant drawing. How one can tell from a voice when people are in the habit, thought Clarissa, of making other people, it's a shade too tight, she said, obey. The shopwoman went off again. Clarissa was left waiting. Fear no more, she repeated, playing her finger on the counter. Fear no more the heat of the sun. Fear no more, she repeated. There were little brown spots on her arm, and the girl crawled like a snail. Thou thy worldly task hast done. Thousands of young men had died that things might go on. At last, half an inch above the elbow, pearl buttons, 5 1/4. My dear slow coach, thought Clarissa, do you think I can sit here the whole morning? Now you'll take 25 minutes to bring me my change. There was a violent explosion in the street outside. The shop women cowered behind the counters. But Clarissa, sitting very upright, smiled at the other lady. Miss Anstruther, she exclaimed.
Thank you very much, Juliet. And now Sylvester is going to read The New Dress.
Mabel had her first serious suspicion that something was wrong as she took her cloak off and Mrs. Barnett while handing her the mirror and touching the brushes and thus drawing her attention perhaps rather markedly to all the appliances for tidying and improving hair, complexion, clothes, which existed on the dressing table, confirmed the suspicion that it was not right. Not quite right. Which, growing stronger as she went upstairs and springing at her with conviction as she greeted Clarissa Dalloway, she went straight to the far end of the room to a shaded corner where a looking glass hung and looked. No, it was not quite right. And at once, the misery which she'd always tried to hide, the profound dissatisfaction, the sense she had had ever since she was a child of being inferior to other people set upon her. Relentlessly, remorselessly, with an intensity which she could not beat off, as she would when she woke at night at home by reading Borrow or Scott. For, oh, these men, oh, these women, all were thinking, what's Mabel wearing? What a fright she looks. What a hideous new dress. Their eyelids flickering as they came up, and then their lids shutting rather tight. It was her own appalling inadequacy. Her cowardice. Her mean, water-sprinkled blood that depressed her. And at once the whole of the room where, for ever so many hours, she'd planned with the little dressmaker how it was going to go, seemed sordid, repulsive, and her own drawing room so shabby, and herself going out puffed up with vanity as she touched the letters on the hall table and said, how dull, to show off. All this now seemed unutterably silly, paltry, and provincial. All this had been absolutely destroyed, shown up, exploded the moment she came into Mrs. Dalloway's drawing room. What she had thought that evening when, sitting over the teacups, Mrs. Dalloway's invitation came was that, of course, she could not be fashionable. It was absurd to pretend it even. Fashion meant cut, meant style, meant 30 guineas at least. But why not be original? Why not be herself, anyhow? And getting up, she'd taken that old-fashioned book of her mother's, a Paris fashion book of the time of the Empire, and had thought how much prettier, more dignified, and more womanly they were then, and so set herself... Oh, it was foolish. Trying to be like them, pluming herself, in fact, upon being modest and old-fashioned and very charming, and giving herself up, no doubt about it, to an orgy of self-love which deserved to be chastised, and so wreaked herself out like this. But she dared not look in the glass. She could not face the whole horror, the pale yellow, idiotically old-fashioned silk dress with its long skirt and its high sleeves and its waist and all the things that looked so charming in the fashion book, and not on her. Not among all these ordinary people. She felt like a dressmaker's dummy standing there for young people to stick pins into. But, my dear, it's perfectly charming, Rose Shaw said, looking her up and down with that little satirical pucker of the lips which she expected, Rose herself being dressed in the height of fashion, precisely like everybody else, always. We are all like flies, trying to crawl over the edge of the saucer, Mabel thought, and repeated the phrase as if she were crossing herself, as if she were trying to find some spell to annul this pain, to make this agony endurable. Tags of Shakespeare, lines from books she'd read ages ago, suddenly came to her when she was in agony, and she repeated them over and over again. Flies trying to crawl, she repeated. If she could say that over often enough and make herself see the flies, she would become numb, chill, frozen, dumb. Now she could see the flies crawling slowly out of a saucer of milk with their wings stuck together, and she strained and strained, standing in front of the looking-glass, listening to Rose Shaw, to make herself see Rose Shaw and all the other people there as flies, trying to hoist themselves out of something or into something. Meager, insignificant, toiling flies. But she could not see them like that. Not other people. She saw herself like that. She was a fly, but the others were dragonflies, butterflies, beautiful insects dancing, fluttering, skimming, while she alone dragged herself up out of the saucer. Envy and spite, the most detestable of the vices, were her chief faults. I feel like some dowdy, decrepit, horribly dingy old fly, she said, making Robert Hayden stop just to hear her say that, just to reassure herself by furbishing up a poor, weak-kneed phrase, and so showing how detached she was, how witty, that she'd not feel in the least out of anything. And, of course, Robert Hayden answered something quite polite, quite insincere, which she saw through instantly, and said to herself directly he went again from some book, lies, lies, lies. For a party makes things either much more real or much less real, she thought. She saw in a flash to the bottom of Robert Hayden's heart. She saw through everything. She saw the truth. This was true, this drawing room, this self, the other false. Miss Millen's little workroom was really terribly hot, stuffy, sordid. It smelt of clothes and cabbage cooking. And yet, when Miss Millen put the glass in her hand and she looked at herself with the dress on, finished, an extraordinary bliss shot through her heart. Suffused with light, she sprang into existence. Rid of cares and wrinkles, what she had dreamed of herself was there. A beautiful woman. Just for a second. She'd not dared look longer. Miss Millen wanted to know about the length of the skirt. There looked at her, framed in the scrolloping mahogany, a grey-white, mysteriously smiling, charming girl. The core of herself. The soul of herself. And it was not vanity only, not only self-love that made her think it good, tender and true. Miss Millen said the skirt could not well be longer. If anything, the skirt, said Miss Millen, puckering her forehead, considering with all her wits about her, must be shorter. And she felt suddenly, honestly, full of love for Miss Millen. Much, much fonder of Miss Millen than of anyone in the whole world, and could have cried for pity that she should be crawling on the floor with her mouth full of pins and her face red and her eyes bulging, that one human being should be doing this for another. And she saw them all as human beings merely, and herself going off to her party, and Miss Millen pulling the cover over the canary's cage, or letting him pick a hemp seed from between her lips. And the thought of it, of this side of human nature, and its patience, and its endurance, and its being content with such miserable, scanty, sordid little pleasures, filled her eyes with tears. And now the whole thing had vanished. The dress, the room, the love, The pity, the scrolloping looking-glass and the canary's cage had vanished, and here she was in a corner of Mrs. Dalloway's drawing-room, suffering tortures, woken wide awake to reality. But it was all so paltry, weak-blooded, and petty-minded to care so much at her age with two children, to be still so utterly dependent on people's opinions, and not have principles or convictions, not to be able to say, as other people did, "There's Shakespeare, there's death, we're all weevils in a captain's biscuit," or whatever it was that people say. She faced herself, straight in the glass. She pecked at her left shoulder. She issued out into the room, as if spears were thrown at her yellow dress from all sides. But instead of looking fierce or tragic, as Rose Shaw would have done, Rose would have looked like Boadicea. She looked foolish and self-conscious and simpered like a schoolgirl and slouched across the room, positively slinking as if she were a beaten mongrel, and looked at a picture, an engraving. As if one went to a party to look at a picture. Everyone knew why she did it. It was from shame, humiliation. "Now the fly is in the saucer," she said to herself, "right in the middle, and can't get out, and the milk," she thought, rigidly staring at the picture, "is sticking its wings together." "It's so old-fashioned," she said to Charles Burt, making him stop, which, by itself, he hated, on his way to talk to someone else. She meant, or she tried to make herself think that she meant, that it was the picture, and not her dress, that was old-fashioned. And one word of praise, one word of affection from Charles would have made it all different to her at the moment. If only he had said, "Mabel, you're looking charming tonight," it would have changed her life. But then she ought to have been truthful and direct. Charles said nothing of the kind, of course. He was malice itself. He always saw through one, especially if one were feeling particularly mean, paltry, or feeble-minded. "Mabel's got a new dress," he said, and the poor fly was absolutely shoved into the middle of the saucer. Really, he would like her to drown, she believed. He had no heart, no fundamental kindness, only a veneer of friendliness. Miss Millen was much more real, much kinder. If only one could feel that and stick to it always. "Why?" she asked herself, replying to Charles much too pertly, letting him see that she was out of temper, or ruffled, as he called it. "Rather ruffled," he said, and went on to laugh at her with some woman over there. "Why," she asked herself, "can't I feel one thing always, feel quite sure that Miss Millen is right, and Charles is wrong, and stick to it, feel sure about the canary, and pity and love, and not be whipped all around in a second by coming into a room full of people?" It was her odious, weak, vacillating character again, always giving at the critical moment and not being seriously interested in conchology, etymology, botany, archaeology, cutting up potatoes and watching them fructify like Mary Dennis, like Violet Searle. Then Mrs. Holman, seeing her standing there, bore down upon her. Of course, a thing like a dress was beneath Mrs. Holman's notice, with her family always tumbling downstairs or having the scarlet fever. Could Mabel tell her if Elmthorpe was ever let for August and September? Oh, it was a conversation that bored her unutterably. It made her furious to be treated like a house agent, or a messenger boy to be made use of. Not to have value. That was it. she thought, trying to grasp something hard, something real, while she tried to answer sensibly about the bathroom and the south aspect and the hot water tap at the top of the house, and all the time she could see little bits of her yellow dress in the round looking-glass, which made them all the size of boot buttons or tadpoles. And it was amazing to think how much humiliation and agony and self-loathing and effort and passionate ups and downs of feeling were contained in a thing the size of a threepenny bit. And what was still odder, this thing, this Mabel Waring, was separate, quite disconnected. And though Mrs. Holman, the black button, was leaning forward and telling her how her eldest boy had strained his heart running, she could see her, too, quite detached in the looking-glass. And it was impossible that the black dot, leaning forward, gesticulating, should make the yellow dot, sitting solitary, self-centred, feel what the black dot was feeling. Yet they pretended. So impossible to keep boys quiet. That was the kind of thing one said. And Mrs. Holman, who could never get enough sympathy and snatched what little there was greedily, as if it were her right, but she deserved much more, for there was her little girl who'd come down this morning with a swollen knee joint, took this miserable offering and looked at it suspiciously, grudgingly, as if it were a halfpenny when it ought to have been a pound, and put it away in her purse. Must put up with it, mean and miserly though it was, times being hard, so very hard. And on she went, creaking, injured Mrs. Holman, about the girl with the swollen joints. Oh, it was tragic. This greed, this clamour of human beings, like a row of cormorants, barking and flapping their wings for sympathy. It was tragic. Could one have felt it and not merely pretended to feel it? But in her yellow dress tonight, she could not wring out one drop more. She wanted it all for herself. She knew. She kept on looking into the glass, dipping into that dreadfully showing up blue pool, that she was condemned, despised, left like this in a backwater because of her being like this, a feeble, vacillating creature. And it seemed to her that the yellow dress was a penance which she had deserved. And if she'd been dressed like Rose Shaw, in lovely, clinging green, with a ruffle of swan's down, she would have deserved that. And she thought that there was no escape for her. None whatsoever. But it was not her fault altogether, after all. It was being one of a family of 10, never having money enough, always skimping and paring, and her mother carrying great cans, and the linoleum worn on the stair edges, and one sordid little domestic tragedy after another. Nothing catastrophic. The sheep farm failing, but not utterly. Her eldest brother marrying beneath him, but not very much. There was no romance. Nothing extreme about them all. They petered out, respectably, in seaside resorts. Every watering place had one of her aunts, even now, asleep in some lodging with the front windows not quite facing the sea. That was like them. They had to squint at things always. And she had done the same. She was just like her aunts. For all her dreams of living in India, married to some hero like Sir Henry Lawrence, some empire builder. Still, the sight of a native in a turban filled her with romance. She had failed utterly. She had married Hubert, with his safe, permanent underling's job in the law courts, and they managed tolerably in a smallish house without proper maids, and hash when she was alone, or just bread and butter. But now and then,
Mrs. Hellman was off, thinking of the most dried-up, unsympathetic twig she had ever met. Absurdly dressed, too, and would tell everyone about Mabel's fantastic appearance.
Now and then, thought Mabel Waring, left alone on the blue sofa, punching the cushion in order to look occupied, for she would not join Charles Burt and Rose Shaw, chattering like magpies, and perhaps laughing at her by the fireplace. Now and then, there did come to her delicious moments. Reading the other night in bed, for instance. Or down by the sea, on the sand, in the sun, at Easter. Let her recall it. A great tuft of pale sand grass, standing all twisted like a shock of spears against the sky, which was blue, like a smooth china egg. So firm, so hard, and then the melody of the waves. Hush, hush, they said, and the children's shouts, paddling, yes. It was a divine moment. And there she lay, she felt, in the hand of the goddess who was the world. Rather a hard-hearted, but very beautiful goddess. A little lamb laid on the altar. One did think these silly things, and it didn't matter, so long as no one's ever said them. Also, with Hubert sometimes, she had quite unexpectedly, or carving the mutton for Sunday lunch, for no reason, opening a letter, coming into a room. Divine moments, when she said to herself, she would never say this to anyone else. This is it. This has happened. This is it. And the other way about it was equally surprising. That is, when everything was arranged, music, weather, holidays, every reason for happiness was there, then nothing happened at all. One wasn't happy. It was flat. Just flat. That was all. Her wretched self again, no doubt. She'd always been a fretful, weak, unsatisfactory mother, a wobbly wife, lolling about in a kind of twilight existence with nothing very clear or very bold or more one thing than another, like all her brothers and sisters, except perhaps Herbert. They were all the same poor, water-veined creatures who did nothing. And in the midst of this creeping, crawling life, suddenly she was on the crest of a wave. That wretched fly. Where had she read the story that kept coming into her mind about the fly and the saucer? Struggled out. Yes, she had those moments. But now that she was 40, they might come more and more seldom. By degrees, she would cease to struggle any more. But that was deplorable. That was not to be endured. That made her feel ashamed of herself. She would go to the London Library tomorrow. She would find some wonderful, helpful, astonishing book, quite by chance, a book by a clergyman, by an American no one had ever heard of, or she would walk down the Strand and drop accidentally into a hall where a miner was telling about the life in the pit, and suddenly she would become a new person. She would wear a uniform. She would be called Sister Somebody. She would never give a thought to clothes again. And forever after, she would be perfectly clear about Charles Burt and Miss Millen and this room and that room, and it would be always day after day as if she were lying in the sun or carving the mutton. It would be idyllic. So she got up from the blue sofa, and the yellow button in the looking-glass got up too, and she waved her hand to Charles and Rose to show them that she did not depend on them one scrap, and the yellow button moved out of the looking-glass, and all the spears were gathered into her breast as she walked towards Mrs. Dalloway and said, "Good night." "But it's too early to go," said Mrs. Dalloway, who was always so charming. "I'm afraid I must," said Mabel Waring. "But," she added, in her weak, wobbly voice, which only sounded ridiculous when she tried to strengthen it, "I have enjoyed myself enormously." "I have enjoyed myself," she said to Mr. Dalloway, whom she met on the stairs. "Lies, lies, lies," she said to herself, going downstairs, and "right in the saucer," she said to herself, as she thanked Mrs. Barnett for helping her, and wrapped herself round and round in the Chinese cloak she had worn these 20 years.
Totally amazing. It was such a privilege to hear those two stories from Virginia Woolf. They were, you know, sublime and delicious, brought alive as part of the Small Wonder Festival. If short stories are the art that can, even if only very rarely, but sometimes achieve perfection, we've certainly heard two perfect examples this evening and two absolutely fantastic, unsurpassable readings. So thank you both so much. And also, I do want to say, I know you both made long journeys in order to be with us this evening and, you know, for short readings in very busy lives. So thank you very, very much. And also, I just want to thank Di, not only for adapting those stories for us for this evening, for suggesting them and for her support for Small Wonder over very many years. Thank you all very much.
I just wanted to say that although they have been adapted for radio when they went out on radio, that was actually, those were the stories in their entirety. And I wanted to add my thanks to both of you because they are incredibly difficult things to read. And that was superbly done. I mean, she's so incredibly modern as a writer. But they're phenomenally difficult to navigate and to get those gradations right and not to overplay or to underdo. And you did it wonderfully. So thank you very much.
Ask the audience to remain seated while we take Juliet, Sylvester and Di back through the auditorium. Thank you very much.